Hello and welcome back for another podcast episode of Acedo Magazine. My name is Emre Şentürk and today I'm going to talk about my latest article that I published on Acedo.com, the online magazine for political and societal analyses. As you know, I'm constantly looking for new topics and trying to make it as interesting as I can. The reason why this might be sometimes a bit difficult is that I'm not trying to be a news outlet and summarize all the stuff that you see on the news. Rather, I want to have like different perspectives on certain things in the political realm, and therefore I often tend to zoom out and put it into the academic context of political science. So it is kind of difficult to make it kind of tangible most of the time. And this is what I try to do a little bit more in this latest article. So what is it about? It is about the policy options that Russia actually had before it invaded Ukraine. Now, the war is ongoing, and I'm definitely also going to pick up on the recent developments or the current situation and where do I think this is going to head. In one of the earlier episodes, I already talked about what I think is going to happen, and I'm going to make an update on this one as well. Just a quick summary, I do believe that we have some kind of a stalemate and Russia is going to seek a certain status quo, so everyone accepts that the newly added territories to Russia are also kind of established and consolidated, but this is not the topic of today. Rather, I want to talk about were there alternatives for Russia to kind of approach things differently instead of going entering into war and starting military action in Ukraine. And of course, this is, and I have to underline it and stress it, because I'm just someone with certainly relevant qualifications and knowledge and experience with all this, but I do not have the full information. There are lots of classified information that I cannot access, and from what is being done on the battlefield or on the political stage, I can just derive certain things in a certain context. So what I'm saying here is purely based on publicly available information, so I cannot really know the truth behind the motives and the potential policy options there were. And this also means that whenever you see something happening in the world, that politicians basically, they engage with all the stuff, they're analyzing it. Very bright people are included in the policy-making process most of the time. There are also faulty policy-making mechanisms and systems. Let's think back at the invasion of Iraq, the second Gulf War in 2003. This is a classic example of groupthink. So all the people involved in the policy process were highly socioeconomically coherent and congruent. It was a very homogeneous group that was making the decisions there, so faulty decision making there with a little balancing input. In most other systems, this is not the case, and even in such homogeneous groups and policy-making processes, when we think about very far-reaching decisions like war and these kind of things, we can expect a certain level of political professionalism to be present there. And therefore, obviously, we need to acknowledge that. And when we analyze it, when we analyze the decision to go to war with Ukraine, we can see that the decision came pretty close to what actually Russia wanted to achieve. In this article, I start off with the political context. It is very important that we dive into that. And as we know, and as all people who are dealing with politics know, often smaller or larger developments that we see in the contemporary political landscape are often grounded in smaller dynamics or developments that happened a couple of decades or sometimes centuries ago. So when we look back at the collapse of the Soviet Union as a very important turning point in Russian history, we can see, and this is what I point out in this article, that basically with the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact under the Soviet Union, it was not only a diplomatic war that was lost by Russia, it was also an ideological war. In the end, we had the Cold War era, which was characterized basically by the bipolar global state order, meaning that there are two superpowers going at each other. So at some point, obviously, we have the spillover effect that we are not only talking about political power any longer, or economic power as well, but also about normative power. So in the Cold War era, the Eastern Bloc around the Soviet Union and the Western Bloc around the United States of America built their alliances around NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's a defense alliance where all members are basically obliged to help each other out in case of foreign aggression. And on the other side, we have the Soviet Union, similarly structured around the Warsaw Pact. It's kind of the counterweight to NATO. And even though this is something political and an alliance that is towards the defense mechanisms, oriented towards the defense mechanisms of those nations, over the years, a very strong ideological component came to the forefront, because the split between the East and the West was basically also the idea that socialism is more successful, or could be more successful in the East, and vice versa, we have the capitalist idea in the West. So after the collapse, obviously, Russia, basically was also ideologically defeated, meaning that it was a very strong point for the United States and NATO nations to attract more members, but also for the case of capitalism, because as we all know, after that we switched from bipolar international state system into a unipolar international state system, and everyone wanted to participate. A lot of countries became capitalist, and they are actually much better off, obviously. But the defeat alone was not enough for NATO, and this is where the problems come in for Russia. Obviously, economically weakened, politically humiliated, basically, and ideologically devastated, Russia needed some time to get back on its feet. But in the meantime, NATO was not satisfied with just defeating or winning defeating Russia or winning this competition, but they really wanted to crush the enemy, because Russia was perceived as an enemy, and nobody wanted to give Russia the chance to get back to the old power. It's similar to Germany's collapse. There was a more productive stance around controlling Germany, because the European Union actually was born out of the idea to control German coal and steel industries, and they did it not also through occupation, obviously, but also through cooperation, and this did not happen with Russia. Instead, the policy that was basically opted for here was isolation. And when we look at the enlargements of NATO over recently, basically very recently after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we can see that they're pretty much oriented towards those ex-Soviet republics, for one, and therefore also bordering with Russia basically limiting the foreign policy space for Russia and the space of movement in the foreign policy realm. Starts off with Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland in 1999, only 9 years after this very turning point. And then we have like this big, it's a very big setback for Russia, as in 2004, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Romania, Lithuania, Slovakia and Slovenia also joined NATO. In 2009, we have Croatia and Albania. More recently, Montenegro in 2017, and most recently, North Macedonia in 2020, Finland in 2023. And this year, Sweden is also joining NATO. So basically, most of the bordering countries on the European side with Russia joined a defense alliance, right, that is obliged to basically give you the give each other military assistance in case of aggression. This in turn means, if we look at the nations that joined, you know, these are all weak nations. I mean, I don't know what kind of help Slovenia would be to Germany in the case of a war. Obviously, there are other ideas behind it. And with this enlargement, NATO nations have the chance to build military capacity in those bordering nations to Russia. Capacity building means, in this case, weapon and development of weapon systems, improving supply lines, sharing expertise, have better surveillance and intelligence access to those regions, but also cross-border to Russia. Border control for Russia is very difficult. And in this kind of situation, where we already, you know, left behind a phase of Cold War and distrust and kind of the animosity, Russia is also right to distrust the West in expanding. I mean, I would have understand it if wealthier and stronger countries were basically part of the enlargement. But I mean, here Poland is, Poland and Bulgaria are the biggest nations that joined, except from Finland. And I mean, as I said, Latvia, Slovenia and Lithuania, the Balticum, as well as Hungary and so on and so forth. I mean, they're not really adding to the defense capacities, but rather add to the proximity to Russia and isolate them foreign policy-wise. So all I want to say is that with reacting in the military sense by invading Ukraine, Russia actually did something that fulfilled the goal of stopping the expansion to the east. Because if Ukraine would have been next and part of NATO or the European Union, obviously all other nations would be obliged to help Ukraine in case of war. So at that point, Russia would have been completely cut off and isolated foreign policy-wise, because towards the West, there's little room to move. I mean, when we think about the energy supply and, for example, you know, the building of pipelines and so on and so forth, it is already kind of difficult, and diplomacy with NATO nations is also very difficult. Ukraine is a very weak state that could have, where you could exert some influence and use diplomatic means. But if Ukraine would have become a NATO member, then this these policy options were also very limited. Would have been very limited for Russia. In order to prevent that, military action was taken. And if Ukraine is to be a NATO member, all of a sudden all other nations would be obliged to attack Russia, triggering a devastating war. Because when around 20 nations attack Russia, obviously the only possible response they can give is with nuclear warfare. And this would be devastating for all participants. So the war actually helped Russia to achieve the goal of stopping the NATO expansion or enlargement to the east. The policy goal is fulfilled. I have to underline that. I'm not putting a value behind the goal. The goal is there, and this is something that is naturally from the dynamics and the history and the context of Russia and the recent history after the Cold War is something that is logical. It is logical that you do not want a large bloc, you know, blocking you off in foreign policy terms and limiting your room in economic and diplomatic policy making towards one of the most important or maybe the most important region in the world, namely Europe. And therefore, it is logical to not want NATO to expand further east. And in the light of this goal, the war achieved it. But now let's turn to the other side of this goal. Were there options? And I do believe, yes, there were options. I mean, we have to also be fair enough to acknowledge that Russia's economic and societal capacities were very limited at the time it became Russia after being the Soviet Union for so long. On the other hand, the capacities are still not quite there yet, neither from the economic perspective nor from the societal perspective. And therefore, we already have another limitation. So this makes the invasion of Ukraine still a little bit more feasible, but there are other policy options. So the idea of stopping NATO expanding east would mean that you, and if these are going to be non-violent means to do that, are purely based on the idea of convincing NATO or important members within NATO that such an expansion is actually bad. And in order to do that, you need to have like kind of the diplomatic basis, you know, to enter into talks and kind of dismantle the environment of distrust that has been around for so long. And in order to do that, obviously you have to convince other nations, but you cannot convince politicians. That's not possible. You are more or less on eye level. Everybody knows what is going on when they are talking to each other. It's very interesting actually when diplomats and heads of governments talk to each other. They know what is going on. They know about the motives and the goals and the ideas of the counterpart. Everybody knows about the interests of the other. And therefore, negotiations are very difficult on that level. It is actually playing with open cards, but pretending not playing with open cards. It is very strange. So in order to give you an example, what can we think about? Yeah, if for example, after Brexit, the United Kingdom, yeah, the politicians, the Prime Minister of United Kingdom at that time, I mean, they switched so many, they changed office so often that I don't remember who was exactly in charge, but basically the Prime Minister, whoever it was at that time, or the Prime Ministers, went around the world and tried to negotiate new trading terms and enter into free trade agreements with certain nations and other economic areas. And this means that when the Prime Minister goes there, the other head of government knows exactly what's going on. You know, they want to get the best rate and the best, in the best case, no tariffs for England. They know it, and accordingly they are negotiating, and they can get concessions from the United Kingdom. And because they know it, it's very difficult for the United Kingdom to negotiate in the situation, because they basically know what they're here for and the situation, and back against the wall and so on and so forth. So it's pretty much with open cards. And the same goes also for Russia. So if Russia would have gone into Europe and talked to politicians and say, hey, well, we don't really like the idea of you expanding east. Don't worry about nothing. We are not going to attack anyone or kind of harm your interests and so on and so forth. And actually, Russia did that. The European politicians are not really buying that. It means the same thing. Russia's back is against the wall. They have a problem. They're trying to talk it out, but there's nothing in for Europe not doing that, or the NATO nations at least. There's nothing in it. You know, if you have to choose between making business with Europe and Russia, obviously you would go for Europe. It's the volume is much greater. It's much safer, and it's also more on a common ground of cultural understanding, you know, that Russians do not have due to being isolated from the European society for so long and never really being that much integrated into it. You know, it's similar to Turkey, always around and next to Europe, but not really part of it. Also doesn't want to be part of it culturally and societally, which is good, which I completely understand and support also. But therefore, talking directly to politicians didn't work. So the only other policy option that Russia actually had was public diplomacy. And public diplomacy is basically the term that depicts the exertion of influence on the population of foreign nations, meaning that if you want the population of another country to think about a certain thing in a certain way, then you call it public diplomacy. Well, we can also call it manipulation. We can also call it propaganda. It's very funny. Because whenever, for example, foreign, if you're in a domestic discourse and a foreign head of government is kind of directing his speech towards a matter of domestic affairs, it's always labeled propaganda. But for example, if the outbound communication towards other populations is made to kind of push for a certain point, it's always public diplomacy, obviously. And I understand this is just conflict of interest. Everybody wants to put the own policy actions into or push it into a good light, and it's all right. But these three words are basically interchangeable: public diplomacy, manipulation, propaganda. Obviously, I stick to the professional term public diplomacy. And this in the Russian policy realm means that Russia could have aimed for the Russian population in Europe, primarily in Germany, where over 3.5 million Russians live actually. Public diplomacy would then entail that Russia is trying to influence or bolster the position of Russians in Germany first, placing them in the civil society, at the crossroad of civil society, in media, building capacity through networks and think tanks, as well as NGOs, as well as, sports clubs and so on and so forth, you know, like leisure clubs and organizations. And why would they do that? Because if you are able to develop capacities and place your population, your ethnic population in another country in a very favorable light, and they're appearing in TV shows, they're associated with positive things, they have great speakers, they add to society, they add to scientific progress, and so on and so forth, and they're very prominent and kind of displayed in media and in public discourse, obviously the population of that country is going to have a very positive and favorable opinion on Russia and Russian people. And that being so, this discourse is also translated into politics, if you want or not, because in the end, this is something that generates a feeling of trust and kind of a normality that Russians, for example, here are placed in this positive light. You know, you associate positive things with them. For example, if we are thinking about Japanese people abroad, usually we tend to think that they are very kind and generous people, or very forthcoming people, and this is because they behave in a certain way, not because their government pushed them to be or supported them with being that way, but just because they are that way and they are also perceived that way. Policy towards Japan and diplomacy towards Japan is kind of easy. But you can also kind of make it state-led to have such perception in a certain country by supporting your population there. And the policy option that Russia had after the Cold War, and obviously they didn't know that NATO planned to expand that far east that quickly, but they could have supported and bolstered the position of Russians in Germany, especially because there are so many of them. And over the years, and this doesn't take long actually, you know, this a quick thing of five to eight years until something like that is consolidated and or at least developed and consolidated over the next over the following 10 years, but then you would kind of also have the spillover effect on other nations within the European Union, of which most of them are already part of NATO. Placing those connotations and creating these positive connotations and creating this very nice and warm climate about the idea of the Russian also enables to have better diplomatic relations in the first place. But then you also need to kind of, and this is where it gets tricky, you also kind of need to convince or at least reduce your kind of the points where European or NATO politicians could attack you. And what do I mean by that? As I said earlier, NATO is not only a military and political association, it has also a common ideological understanding. And whenever NATO is making authoritative statements or basically gathering behind a political cause, it is always also an ideological message that is being transmitted to the world. And in the case of Russia, it is always criticized that, yeah, it's illicit policymaking, dictatorship, authoritarian, and so on and so forth. So we all know that, right? Russia should have done a better job of hiding how policymaking actually works in Russia. Not in the sense of censoring and isolating itself, but rather showing, emphasizing the positive points that are aligned with European ideas and or the Western ideas and the NATO ideas on the one hand, and on the other side covering other things up and making those illicit policy mechanisms so much illicit that you cannot really access them and really don't have it on your agenda. And the reason is not that Russia should pretend to be something else. It is not. I mean, it is the decision of Russian people, or it is the dynamic of Russian culture, to make policy in a certain way. And it is not the business of any other than Russians, to judge how policymaking or whether policymaking is good or not there. And in my article, I also gave a very good example, and this is China, which is also battling with the allegations of being such a dictatorial state, and I mean, it's not allegations, obviously it's a dictatorial state, but in the end, the reason why Western nations are not cooperating with or are cooperating with China, even though they have the perception of China being dictatorial or at least authoritarian, is that they are basically ignoring all the criticisms and covering up much of what is actually bad in the eyes of the West and emphasizing what is positive. So they're very rigorous in their approach. For example, points A, B, C are being criticized by the West and especially NATO. They're ignoring it completely, and they're reducing the access to those information and to those, or making the evidence or finding evidence of these occasions so hard that in the discourse about Chinese policy making, this is not really talked about. So when we think about China, we know, yeah, well, it's kind of a dictatorship or very authoritarian, state-led, etc., etc. But we do not have really the example or very tangible results or evidence that it is that way. And in public discourse, we also do not have those this talk. We just have the idea about it. And that is still okay for the West to make business with China, and Russia could have done the same thing. But in Russia, we have very tangible results because there are oligarchs on their yachts in European harbors. There are oligarchs that are buying football clubs in Europe. This is very tangible. I mean, the way Russian businessmen behave in Europe, or behaved at least before all that happened, is actually very tangible for the populations, and it just is very bad for the reputation of Russia. Before, I talked about influencing the public opinion in a positive way, but this is the other way around. And politicians know that, and they know the sentiment of European people towards Russia in those occasions, and therefore the diplomatic field is not very fruitful for Russia. And this should have been managed much better. It's not like the oligarchy in Russia should have been dismantled. I mean, it works, for example, in the United States as well. But it should have been a bit more digestible for the diplomatic stage, especially towards NATO. And Russia wasn't able to do that, and that would have been another supportive policy action that could have prevented or at least mitigated the effects of NATO expansion policy. But within a negative climate, where Russia and Russians were already not really perceived in an overly positive way in Europe, and especially in the NATO nations, plus the way policy, the policy making works in Russia, there was no really the chance to apply diplomatic tactics and expect NATO to react on that. There is also a bit more an aggressive way that Russia could have acted, and this is to also place military bases in bordering nations. But I mean, as we know how Western societies work, you know, they always see what they want, and if somebody applies the same tactic, it's overly bad, and the own actions are completely ignored. So the reaction would have been a more drastic approach to the East, and I understand that Russia always tried to, you know, be kind of diplomatic about the expansions to the East first, but it did not help because on the other side, the public diplomacy efforts were not enough. Ideally, Russia could have influenced European public opinion to such a degree that it would have, there would have resistance against any actions taken against Russia, for example. But this is very difficult to achieve and takes a lot of time, a lot of economic resources, a lot of societal resources, but it's much more sustainable. And on the other side, even if NATO is expanding or was to expand further east within such a pro-Russian climate within Europe, the Russians there and also the domestic populations, the indigenous populations of Europe, would have basically also stood up against such diplomatic efforts. So you can really, once you are basically, and I'm using this word because it's kind of what it is, if you are able to infiltrate a foreign nation's population and kind of give them the opinions or make them think about certain topics the way you want them to think, this is a very powerful tool, because once something happens, you can always turn back to those populations and kind of trigger counter movements. And once this political pressure is in place, the results are much more in your favor and the negative effects are mitigated. But if you want a hard mechanic result, obviously the invasion was the way to go. I mean, in the case of Ukraine, because it is a very weak political and obviously very corrupt political system, that and there were reasons why Ukraine was never in NATO and the European Union, it is still kind of acceptable to a certain degree. The whole resistance of the West against Russia on the matter of Ukraine is just a purely tactical and strategic one, not an ideological one. And that is very important. So if the same was the case with Georgia, where there's not really the there wasn't really the pushback from the international community, at least not in the physical sense. But if Poland or the Baltic states or Bulgaria, for example, would have been or Romania would have been targeted by Russia couple of years ago in order to stop the NATO expansion, obviously before those nations joined NATO, the reaction would have been completely different, because those nations, maybe not Bulgaria or Romania, but at least the Baltic states and Poland, because those nations are, first of all, way too close to the core nations of Europe, first of all, and then second of all, the history and the support and the societal setup is too close to European culture, and is too kind of intertwined with the idea of Europeanism that the West could have been kind of neutral, or had adopted a neutral stance or more passive stance on this matter. So it is kind of tricky, and or within the available information, or kind of the window of available information, I think Russia may have adopted a route that is least harmful to their interests and to their goals, potentially. But as I said, there are basically other policy options. And those policy options, or there were policy options, and those policy options were basically centered around societal manipulation, as I said, public diplomacy, and kind of infiltrating or making the ideational warfare in order to influence the opinion and perception of Europeans, of Russians. It is also riskier, certainly. But the biggest advantage that I see in such an approach is that when you are able to kind of place the idea of the positive Russian within Europe and create a diplomatic landscape or diplomatic ground with those core nations, especially Germany, then obviously you can also you get also more concessions from that side in diplomatic talks. But on the other side, let's suppose it does not work. What you do then? Then you still have the opportunity or the policy option to invade Ukraine, as it happened. And this is the biggest advantage of trying those things first before resorting to violence. And this is always preferable if you have certain goals and interests. I mean, it is not preferable and not desirable in the universal sense, because when we think about the devletist principles of every nation needing to develop an organic understanding for policymaking and needs to be organic in its development, then we have kind of with this infiltration and public diplomacy efforts, the big problem that it will lead to internal rifts in the long run, for the Europeans in this case. But for the Russians, it would have been a perfect policy alternative. So there is kind of the conflict between the individual interest of Russia and the collective interest of Europe or the international state order. It is very complex, yes. Maybe there are also more policy options. These are just the options that I explored for now. What I want to say is, it is very tactical. It is very not only tactical but also technical, because in the end, it is not about having a certain stance and supporting one side or one policy that has been adopted or not. It is rather to explore the different ways states can act and how they act within certain goal frameworks. So here we focused on what is the goal of Russia and did they achieve it? Yes, they achieved it. This does not mean that what they did is good. And this does not mean that this is good for the collective international state interest. This does not mean, this only means that it is good for Russia in terms of this specific goal. If the goals of Russia would have been different, then this might also be a very destructive way and not in the interest of Russia. So it always changes in what kind of light you are seeing it and what kind of goals you want to achieve. In this case, it worked, but it could have worked better, and it could have worked more sustainably, because in the end, when you apply public diplomacy efforts, you have something that you can build on in the long run. Right now, if Russian troops pull out of Ukraine, be sure 2 days later, Ukraine is going to apply for NATO membership, and then it's over. Then you have no foreign policy room any longer, and then you're completely isolated and cut off Europe. So, very long and complex talk. I hope that you had that I was able basically to give you some ideas and trigger some thoughts on this. If you have any questions or would like to react to this episode, I'm more than happy to receive your emails. If you want to read the article in full length, then please visit isido.com. Obviously, I'm going to share the link with you. And yeah, I hope to have you back for the next episode of Isido Magazine. And of course, while we're on the topic, if you have interest in a certain topic that I should treat, either in this podcast or also as an article, please let me know. I'm always happy to have those inputs. I always like the inspiration that is coming from you, and therefore I would be more than happy to have some topic suggestions. Thank you very much. And yeah, hear you next time for Acido Magazine. So take care and bye.